46 years have passed since the U.S. Supreme Court legalized abortion. It may be settled law, but the court's landmark ruling in Roe v. Wade continues to generate fierce debate in statehouses and courthouses across the country. Over the years, abortion opponents have sought to limit Roe's impact by restricting on a state-by-state basis precisely when, where, and how a woman can terminate a pregnancy. Hi, I'm John Chwanis, and on this week's program, we'll examine Indiana's role in the ongoing social, legal, and political battle over a woman's right to choose. Indiana lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
What if an app could give a voice to children silenced by autism? It can. Introducing SpeakAll. To learn more about this and more than 400 other world-changing Purdue technologies, visit otc-prf.org.
This was a big week in the ongoing battle over abortion rights here in Indiana. On Monday, a legislative committee voted along party lines to advance a bill that would essentially ban dilation and evacuation, a procedure primarily associated with second trimester abortions. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court was scheduled to consider taking up a lower court's injunction against a 2016 state law that would prohibit abortions tied to a genetic disease or physical deformity and require most aborted fetuses to be buried or cremated. Joining me to talk about what's at stake are Indiana Solicitor General Thomas M. Fisher, who handles the state's highest profile litigation, Democratic Representative Sue Arrington of Muncie, former Public Policy Director for Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky, and Shruti Rana, Professor of International Law Practice at Indiana University's Hamilton Lugar School of Global and International Studies. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate this. So we sort of, and as we tape this, we don't want to deceive anybody. We're taping this before the Supreme Court's scheduled consideration of the cert petition about whether to take this case. But if, in fact, it goes as expected, that's a pretty interesting set of bookends for this week, with the legislative action earlier in the week and perhaps the Supreme Court development. Tom Fisher, which is more significant in the big scheme?
Look, I think it's important to have cases that the court feels like it can consider so that we can learn a little bit more about not only where the new justices might be on abortion issues, but also what the meaning of some of the more recent precedents turns out to be. I think there's a big uncertainty about the case from a couple of years ago on the Texas admitting privileges case and how that applies in other situations. There's also a lot of uncertainty about other ancillary abortion rights. And in our case, you know, whether it extends to the right to decide that you don't want a baby just based on race, sex, or disability, or once you have an abortion, how the fetal remains need to be treated. So I think we're interested in learning whether the court, number one, is interested in taking up these issues, and number two, then how it's going to analyze these cases that don't go right to the heart of Roe and Casey, but that are still important in terms of regulating the abortion right.
And the Supreme Court, or I should say the state, has filed an appeal more recently on another portion of Indiana statute related to restrictions on abortion, and that's the 18-hour ultrasound waiting period. Now that, again, that petition for cert was filed afterwards, so presumably if this doesn't go, shall I say, your way, you have another shot in the coming months.
Yeah, well, and who knows, how the court makes these decisions. We're hopeful that they'll be interested in both cases. The set of issues in the 18-hour ultrasound case are somewhat different. I think they, again, though, raise the question of, what is the scope of Hellerstedt from a couple of years ago, and how does it reach issues relating to informed consent that we had thought was settled law in favor of reasonable state regulatory efforts. So I think, there's still a fair amount that the court is in a position to consider, even aside from, Roe and Casey itself.
Sparrington, again, you've followed these issues both as a lawmaker and certainly, as I pointed out in your introduction, as a staff member and policy director for Planned Parenthood. So you've seen a lot. How closely do your colleagues, do you think, are they watching the proceedings at the federal level and at the Supreme Court when they're dealing with state issues still? I mean, for instance, Monday's committee vote, do they have one eye on the cert schedule and what the Supreme Court will do, or are they, do you think, operating largely devoid of outside influence?
Well, I think it depends on the legislator. There may be some that are
You mean legislators don't all act in unison? Not
some
monolithic.
Some may be zeroed in. But I would say most are basically looking at what are we doing here at the State House and what's up next.
Well, a lot of times, I mean, we've been around long enough to hear on a lot of issues, I'm not talking about abortion necessarily, lawmakers and legislative leadership will say, you know, it's pointless to take up this issue because X, Y, or Z is pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. It would be foolish to take something up now. And again, I'm not even talking about abortion. Why is it then that on this issue there doesn't seem to be that same willingness to wait? I mean, we've had any number of pieces of legislation that have been signed and are now waiting for a decision.
Well, you'd think they would wait. But I think there are outside interests that the advocates, particularly on those who would like to limit or eliminate abortion, who sort of drive the narrative and keep legislators involved. And it's not just Indiana. Some of these laws that we end up considering are tried out in other states as well. So it's sort of like, you know, it's a market.
Well, if you do look at the bills, and they all get their sort of nicknames, the heartbeat bill, the informed consent bill, parental notification bill, they do seem, Professor, to, I won't say cookie cutter, but there are some themes that we see, and they often are based on their thematic in nature. That might be you go through several years where it's a lot about the health and safety of the woman, of the mother. It's then it might be the dignity of the fetus or equal protection for those with disabilities. But it all does seem to happen in waves. Who is quarterbacking this, do you sense?
Well, I definitely think you're correct in that there are shifting strategies, but the overall strategy remains the same, right? Basically, throw as much as you can against the wall and see what sticks. But despite, you know, whatever strategies are being implemented, the core principle is the same, right? Whether we're going to respect the Constitution and respect the fact that women have fundamental equal rights under the Constitution.
And so a lot of states, again, have tested some of these issues, and the appeals are pending. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, Indiana has filed amicus briefs in a number of those. So it seems like everybody's rushing to be to the front to wave the hand in front of the Supreme Court, saying, "I want to be the state that sets precedent." Is that an oversimplification?
No, I think that's correct. I think people are filing as many challenges as they can, again, just to see what sort of facts and what particular situation the Supreme Court wants to take up. And thus far, haven't taken up very many.
Tom Fisher, is this the spaghetti on the wall principle that you throw as much, or is that, you know, I don't want to, just as I suggested, all lawmakers were acted in unison as a monolith. I didn't mean to suggest that, nor am I suggesting that, you know, everybody is taking a cook in the kitchen approach. But do you agree with the philosophy, the strategy as a litigator that you put it up there? Does it make your job better or
we don't
or
pick and choose
difficult?
Our cases. I mean, they come to us.
As you often point out.
Yeah, they come to us as a function of legislative enactment and plaintiffs' decisions about what cases to bring. And we defend what's brought to us, and we defend it vigorously. And, you know, we press the arguments that we think will be successful. So I don't think you can look at amicus briefs or other Supreme Court filings and say, well, here's this national strategy. It's just states that are trying to defend enactments by their state legislatures.
And you talk about trying to put forth the best defense or offense, depending on who the appellant is. Which of, and I don't think Indiana has had since 2013, correct me if I'm wrong, an abortion restriction, a specific abortion restriction that has actually gone into effect. They've all been stayed at the district court level, and then perhaps that was backed up at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Of those that are out there,
that's actually not correct. It's actually not correct because there was an enactment a year ago requiring annual inspections of abortion clinics that has never been enjoined.
So one has gone. Is among those, which is going to be your best shot? Which is the easiest to defend? As you weigh, let's get inside your head here.
Well, look, I think they all have different arguments for and against that come to the table, and I think we've been A little concerned about the Supreme Court's Hellerstedt decision and how far it reaches, and we're certainly very interested in trying to understand that a little bit better. And that is an issue that has sharpened up a little bit more in the ultrasound case. But I got to tell you what, this case that the court is considering tomorrow or on Friday as the fifth time in conference on the anti-eugenics rule. I mean, that is profound, and that in terms of respecting the rights of minorities and women and persons with disabilities, that is an absolutely critical case. So we are very hopeful that the court's going to take that up.
That was interesting. You just used the term anti-eugenics law.
That's all not my term, by the way. That's a term that Judge Easterbrook of the Seventh Circuit used to label.
Well, I'm intrigued always by the lexicon and the way that bills are described. I mean, all the way back to beer baron legislation, which I'm convinced, which had nothing to do with this, certainly, but whoever came up with that was pretty potent. And we hear partial birth abortion, or now with the case, with the legislation that was in the spotlight this past Monday, it's dismemberment abortion. How much does that sort of nomenclature, is that part of the battle here to how it's framed in the minds not only of jurists but voters?
Yes, I think the wording is important and it's picked for its effect. I mean, there's actually, as you mentioned earlier, a medical name for that procedure, dilation and
evacuation.
But that's not what appears in the bill. It's the more emotional wording is what is in the bill.
Do you find your constituents react differently compared with whether the medical term is used or something like dismemberment?
I'm sure people do.
I mean, how important is that part of this chess game, would you say, Professor?
I think it's very important because I think, if you look at the public, most people have lives to lead and they're not focusing on Supreme Court decisions or at least not reading them line by line. And so there's an open space for people to mischaracterize medical procedures or to use inflammatory or inaccurate language. And sort of try to set the try to shift the terms of the debate using basically marketing techniques, right? We know that marketing techniques work, and I think, it's a chance for politicians often to try to reframe issues that the general public isn't going to spend their time poring over Supreme Court decisions or legal terms or medical terms either. And I think in most cases it's quite unfortunate and often misleading to the public.
Tom Fisher, how advantageous to your cause in these cases that you will be arguing, presumably, is the new makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court? I mean, we hear so much. The conventional wisdom, of course, is that one reason we see such a flurry of activity in state houses across the country is that people sense that the time is right. When I say people, opponents of abortion sense that the time is right.
Well, there's no denying that I think there's a great level of hope that Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh will be receptive to arguments in defense of abortion regulations. I don't think we really know at this point their attitudes on these things, and we're waiting to learn, I think, more and more case by case. It was, at some level, encouraging that Justice Kavanaugh was willing to weigh in the Louisiana June medical case in the stay, disagreeing with that, to suggest that he's engaged on the issues.
Say that was heartening. How disheartening then was it that Indiana's own Chief Justice John Roberts, I think we can claim him as a Hoosier, right? I think he spent his formative years here, actually surprised a lot of people, maybe even you, although you're an experienced court watcher, you probably don't get surprised very often, that he sided with the quote-unquote liberals, four liberals, to stay that Louisiana.
Yeah, we really don't know why. I mean, there is a long tradition at the court where you've got four votes to take a case that a fifth vote will jump in and say, okay, we can stay it just as a courtesy because we know that the court's likely to take the case and there's no reason to change the status quo or let things continue on knowing that we're going to take it. So that may be the rationale. We really don't know. I'm still optimistic.
But he could come back and once this is decided on its merits, reach an entirely different
conclusion. Absolutely. And I'm still optimistic that he'll be persuaded that Louisiana is the better argument. But, at this point, we really don't know. And I think there are different issues presented by different cases that will give an opportunity for the justices, if they are willing to engage on these issues, to let their views be known.
How worried are you about the current makeup of the court?
It makes me nervous. sometimes people surprise you. The author of Roe v. Wade decision, was appointed by a Republican president, and I think that was
Justice Blackmun, sort of, right?
Yeah, that was surprising to a lot
my
of court.
History class paid off, I guess. So you're hoping on for surprises here, or perhaps that John Roberts, because of his interest in court precedents and the perception that the court is acting in something other than partisan interest, that he might preserve Roe v. Wade for at least the foreseeable future?
At this point, it's really too early to tell.
Professor, do you see one, as you look at the legal landscape, one of these laws or one of the arguments that they have produced, the cases and the appeals that they've produced, that seems potentially threatening to Roe v. Wade? I mean, and we, as we look at, just to summarize, I mean, we could stay here all day, but everything from the treatment of remains to 18-hour waiting periods, ultrasound, to admitting privileges for physicians, which was what was at the heart of the Louisiana law. I mean, where is the biggest threat for those who want to see Roe v. Wade maintained?
Right. So I think all of those restrictions and all of those laws are clearly unconstitutional under Roe. There's just no question at all. And Whole Women's Health really reinforced that. So the real question is a much larger rule of law question that we have at stake now, that's more than abortion and more than women's rights. And the real question right now is the Supreme Court going to respect its prior precedents, and is it going to read the Constitution as promoting equality for women? And the other question is, and I think this really came out with the stay that you're describing with Justice Roberts on voting with the liberals on the stay, is whether I think what he did was to say that the Supreme Court is going to respect precedents, at least to some extent. And what he did was basically say that lower courts couldn't just ignore decisions that they didn't like. Right? If the stay had not gone into effect, that would have been the ultimate rule of law effect, and that would have affected so many cases out there on all sorts of issues, right? If the circuit courts could just decide they were going to ignore Supreme Court precedent whenever they encountered something they didn't like, that would just be so damaging to our court system, to democracy, you know, to the rights of all Americans.
Tom Fisher, pretend, squint, and imagine that the three of us are just blossomed into the nine members of the Supreme Court. And you're up there. You're. This is oral arguments. We're just getting some rehearsal.
We'll have more success with you guys. We
won't talk about your decision this week on the forfeiture case. But what is the argument you would make if one of the justices says, "Gee, counselor, what about stare decisis? So what about this notion that we should have stability in our laws?" What's your argument for countering that?
Oh, well, my view on stare decisis in general has always been that precedent is important, stability is important, but the more fundamental, the more foundational the question is, the more important it is to get the answer right. And I think that is the most important and critical question for the court to confront. Is this as fundamental as this is, are we getting the answer right? And that's the backbone, that's the substance of what it means to have the rule of law. And I think, you know, when it comes to questions that don't necessarily go to the heart of Roe and Casey, I think we're talking about what is a doctrine that lower courts can apply faithfully. I mean, part of the problem with Hellerstedt and trying to apply it to Louisiana is no one's really sure what Hellerstedt means. Does it mean that all laws are unconstitutional, you know, if they require visiting privileges, or does it mean that it all depends on the facts in each state? And I think that there's a big disagreement about what Hellerstedt means, and I think that there's a very big need for the court to step in and clarify that, and you know, maybe we'll get that in June Medical.
You can tell us later which justices you envisioned when you saw us in your imaginary scenario there, who will play the parts in the movie. Sue Arrington, where are Hoosiers on this issue? I mean, we've seen the numbers nationally that Planned Parenthood puts out, 71-73% in favor of abortion rights. But again, it's any surveys depends on how the question is asked, I presume. But what's your gut of Hoosier's sentiments on this?
I think that Hoosiers want women and their doctors to be able to make these decisions without interference of the politicians.
Why
they see it as an individual decision.
Why then do you think, and I think mathematics in the makeup of the General Assembly has a lot to do with it, but why is it that you and other supporters of abortion rights are always on the defensive? I mean, at least it has seemed that way as long as I can remember. Is it simply a matter of the mathematics of which party's in control?
I think that's a lot of it, and I think You know, when you've got a right and you've had it for a while, you tend to think it's always going to be there. And if you're opposed to that right, then you're fighting against it. There may be more motivation to be active when you're trying to change something than when you like what you've got.
You don't appreciate it till it's gone.
That's
scenario,
right.
Feeling.
And you know, I can remember, I'm old enough, I can remember when abortion was illegal. And I know women who had illegal abortions. And so when I see these bills come before me, that's what comes into my mind, is here's another attempt to move us back to those days when you didn't have the right to make your own decisions.
Yeah, some states certainly have gone on the offensive. Again, it's from the perspective, I'll say, of abortion rights supporters. New York just this year enacted or expanded an existing statute, if I'm not mistaken, Professor, that basically was a bulwark against whatever decision is made, whether now or in the future, on Roe v. Wade. And California, if I'm not mistaken, has a constitutional guarantee. Is it a matter of mathematics? And is that why some states are pushing one direction and others, as in the cases in Indiana, it's almost always pushing toward more restrictive legal climate?
Yeah, I actually don't think it's a matter of mathematics. I think it's a matter of politics. I think, you know, studies show over and over, and I think it's just, you know, a matter of common sense that both Hoosiers and as well as Americans all over the country really hold personal liberty interests to be one of the most critical parts of the Constitution, right, and support liberty rights. But often, you know, often those views are hijacked or manipulated by politicians. And I think that that's one of the real issues that's at stake with the Whole Women's Health v. Hellerstadt case that we've been discussing. Because if you take abortion out of the equation of that case and you look at what the Supreme Court was saying, one of the things they were saying was that you couldn't substitute politicians' opinions for people's personal choices or when medical evidence was to the contrary, right? And if Whole Women's Health were to be overruled, that basically means you could substitute politicians' opinions even if, you know, for personal choices, even if all the evidence was against that, even if people, you know, didn't want to exercise their liberty in that manner and really end up imposing on people's liberty. And I think that's something that's really important to understand about Whole Women's Health, that it has profound implications, not just for abortion, but basically for any state legislative decision and any decision where politicians are trying to substitute their opinions or judgment for personal decisions.
And now, as we look into the future, given what you've just said, if Roe v. Wade, again, who's to say now or in the future, were overturned, Counselor, we would go basically back to what we saw before 46 years ago, which is it's the purview of the states, each state, to determine abortion legalities?
Right.
And is that the way it should be in your mind?
Look, I think the most important thing to understand is going back to what Professor just said, which was when we look at the array of everyday liberties and rights, when we look at legislative regulation, we don't subject it to some kind of scientific testing in a courtroom. And what the court did in Hellerstedt was basically to elevate abortion above everything else, except, you know, perhaps compared to other to the Bill of Rights itself. And to say, well, you were going to subject every legislative decision to scientific testing in a courtroom. And so I think overruling Roe and Casey would get us back to a situation where we're not talking about that kind of sort of super standard applicable
to state by state battle. And you may get the last word. Time flies here. But Sue Arrington, quickly, if Roe v. Wade were overturned, would Indiana, do you think, be in the abortion rights column where women could still get an abortion, or would it be off the table?
Well, when Roe v. Wade passed, Indiana did have a ban, and that was when they were cleaning out the rule book, they got rid of it. So in order for Indiana to be able to ban abortion, the legislature would have to take action again.
So we'll schedule another discussion for that point. Thank you all for coming here and sharing your obvious knowledge on the subject. It's much appreciated. Again, my guests have been Indiana Solicitor General Thomas M. Fisher, Democratic Representative Sue Arrington of Muncie, and Shruti Rana of Indiana University's Hamilton Lugar School of Global and International Studies.
It accounts for more than half of the state budget, so it's time to get schooled on the state of K-12 education on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight, part of Hanna News Service. Ed, one bill that I didn't talk about with the roundtable, Curt Nisley, a Republican from Goshen, for the third straight year, he introduced legislation that would ban all abortions. You know, no caveats, no this, that. It's now it didn't get a hearing again. What do we read into that? Why are there people so willing to throw spaghetti at the wall on other aspects of this issue, but not when it comes to a complete ban?
Well, I think the Speaker of the House, Brian Bosma, said it best. He said, I'm not into buying a lawsuit. And I think at this point, with the current composition of the Supreme Court, without any kind of clear indication as to where they may go and potentially changing, you know, Roe v. Wade and settled case law, it's not something that the state of Indiana wants to be the first one in the race to the courthouse on. Even the Republican governor of Iowa decided that she wasn't going to be pushing in the courts an argument that she felt was not quite ripe yet for dispute on abortion issues.
So a few states are willing, they're pushing sort of other states aside because they do want to be there if, in fact, that the Gorsuch-Kavanaugh and lineup is as conducive to an overturn of Roe v. Wade as they think.
Sure, and as the Solicitor General said, you know, you can only deal with the laws that you're given, and it's not like they can go and go to the court on their own on something.
I should have pointed out during the roundtable that we talked about a bill that came out of committee this week. The authors of that, co-authors of that bill, we invited all of them to appear on the show. Why do you think people, and maybe it's a schedule conflict that they all three had, but do you think there's a reluctance to talk about this issue outside the controlled confines, if you can say that, about the State House?
It's an emotional thing, and I think Representative Arrington kind of said it in a different context about how it's a little bit easier to oppose these kinds of things, and when you've had something for so long, you know, you kind of get used to it, and you know, it's really the flip side of that one on this.
Of course, this was not on anybody's formal agenda in terms of the caucuses or the governor.
No.
Does the governor see this not be an issue this session?
Yeah, I think he believes in the Daniels principle about, you know, let's leave some of those social wedge issues outside of the statewide agenda. And you know, if legislators want to do it, well, we'll consider it when it gets to us. But it doesn't have to get to us. You know, it's not like the hate crime thing where, you know, he came out and said, yes, I want to see something.
It was one of his priorities. Very good, Ed. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you, as always, for your insight. Appreciate it. For more information, episode streams, and other extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis, and on behalf of WFYI Public Media, Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, and my colleague Ed Feigenbaum, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House coverage. Until next week, take care.
Purdue researchers are finding new ways to treat cancer, provide drug-free therapies, advance wound repairs, reduce chronic illness symptoms, helping people, changing lives. Purdue Research Foundation. Contact innovation at prf.org.